to Adventures in Artslandia. I'm sitting across from Chris Coleman at Portland Center Stage, and we are going to talk today about a program at Portland Center Stage called Northwest Stories. And it's very exciting because there are four plays on your season coming up that are part of this, and then there are four commissions that are mm-hmm. also part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so exciting for me, not only as a member of the theater community, but also as a community member, to see stories that are about diversity coming to the fore.
Mm.
And it's also exciting because you happen to be adapting one mm-hmm. of them mm-hmm. That'll be in the season. And it's based on the book Astoria mm-hmm. by Peter Stark, which is so interesting because every year my husband takes a day on his birthday and he goes away. He goes all the way by himself and he reads a book. And it was Astoria this year.
Oh my gosh.
So he's really excited.
Good
about
choice.
This. Yeah.
Good choice.
See, he's on the cutting edge and he didn't even know it.
Yeah. Wow.
So tell us a little bit about what led you and the company toward the Northwest Stories. It's really thrilling.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We had an opportunity. We were invited maybe 18 months ago to apply for a program that the Wallace Foundation was putting together out of New York. And it was, they invited about 80 of us to come to them with a proposal about how we might broaden, deepen, or diversify a particular part of our audience. And they chose 26 of us, and we thought long and hard about, well, what part of our audience are we having some success with, and we think we'd have a chance of actually moving the dial. And we focused on 25 to 40 year olds. One, because we'd seen some growth there, but also because there's a huge influx in that demographic in the community. And then as we started to brainstorm about, well, how would we connect to them? You know, and how do we had a bunch of different ideas, but some of the pieces, some of the plays over the years that have had the best result in that demographic have had a particular tie to the Northwest. And so that's, you're talking about Sometimes a Great Notion, or One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, or Crazy Enough, or the People's Republic of Portland. They had some tie to this community. And so our pitch to the foundation was, we think that there may be some resonance for us to mine there, and we'd love to have some more resources to experiment with that. And they bought it, And you know, it's interesting, Susanna, you know, when you start thinking about a particular topic, other things start to kind of gravitate toward you and that you hadn't considered. So I would never have imagined that our second year into this cycle, we would have, you know, four plays in a series related to the Northwest. That seemed like we'd never find projects. But then once you start thinking about that, you know, you start to smell them. And I think we all, yeah, we love those ideas and the connections to the community. So we were talking about authors that we could commission, and then we started, as we were putting the season together, we started to see projects that might kind of fit into this and got excited about including them, and Astoria is indeed a huge piece of that.
I looked also at the Oregon Trail. I've watched that over the years. I've heard about it, and then did I see a reading of it, or I can't quite remember how it came into my universe, but especially touched me because of my kids going through school and playing that Oregon Trail
game. Oh, did they?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, in elementary school. And wow. I really enjoyed it. And, of course, immediately, first of all, I know you're an incredible advocate of arts and education mm-hmm. in the city. And to my mind, theater is just one of the number one ways to get kids interested in stories. And stories all have some sort of historical resonance.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems as though all of these plays, the commissions and the plays that are already on the docket for this season, will be an incredible way for parents, and maybe that demographic includes parents, to bring their children and have stories to talk about, you know?
Well, and it's funny you say that because we just did a two-week workshop of Astoria
mm-hmm.
and then showed it to the public on Sunday. It was, you know, a small group, but I overheard this kid coming back at intermission. I'm going to guess the guy was 20,
mm-hmm.
Maybe saying to his mom or somebody, so how much of this do you think is true? You know, and I thought, oh my God, I love that. And somebody, our literary manager, was asking me afterwards, well, do you think we should put something in the program? I said, no. What a fantastic outcome that maybe somebody's curiosity gets piqued. Maybe he picks up the book. Maybe he starts to do his own research mm-hmm. about this particular chapter in our region's history. To me, that was delightful. And then my board chair actually brought his two boys, who I'm guessing were 8 and 11, and they had never been to the theater before. And I didn't think to ask him why he decided to bring them to this. But he asked them afterwards if they followed. He was afraid they'd fall asleep, and they stayed totally engaged. And he said they had really quite interesting discussion afterwards. Of course, it's all new. The story of Astoria is... It was new to me. I assumed Oregonians would know it. Most do not or didn't.
Gary's a lifelong Oregonian. He did not know it. He was blown away. He was so fascinated. And he said, you know, that Astor was, you know, the Bill Gates of his time. And that's really exciting stuff.
Yeah. It's an astounding story. And, you know, and I just got obsessed with it. I had a couple of donors recommend it to me because they know I'm kind of a history nut. Mm-hmm. And, you know, initially I thought it sounded like a slog, you know. And then I picked it up and started reading it, and I couldn't put it down. And I was so knocked out by how harrowing the journey was and how poor the leadership skills were. I mean, it was just like every bad decision you could think of. And I couldn't stop talking about it. I just became a little obsessed with it. And everybody I would sit down with, I was talking about this damn book. And so I reached out to the author and said, would you consider letting me adapt it? And he said, I have no idea how you'd go about that because it's so sprawling.
Right.
But sure, go for it. And I didn't either. I didn't have any clue what form it would take.
I can imagine at the outset of a project like that, you would just feel kind of petrified. I mean, excited by the prospect of, you, wow, green light, we're going. And then like, wow, we're
now
going.
Now I have to do this.
Right.
Now I have to actually figure out how to write
That's kind of like how people who listen to our artists might know. You write a rack grant, for instance, and then you get it and you think,
now,
okay.
What do I do?
Now I do it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's nice because you have a schedule. You have an opening night.
You have an opening night, and that is, I remember I had a friend who runs a theater in New York say one time that the most valuable thing you can give a writer is a deadline.
Yeah, it's so true. You know where you're headed. I mean, it's like being on a trail. Funny analogy, but mm-hmm. you're on a road and you're going somewhere. Mm-hmm. You don't actually, in that case, know where you're going to end up.
No, and in this case, I, you know, didn't know how in the world, you know, how are you going to put a ship on stage? You know, you can't do it literally, so
right.
How do you do it theatrically? And how do you let them travel, you know, across the Rockies and get stuck? And, you know, it's so fun to work on.
Oh, I bet. So now you just finished this
workshop,
mm-hmm. and then will you have another one, or?
No, basically what I'm doing right now is I'm leaving it alone for a minute because I got so much feedback on it, and I feel like, you know, it needs to, like, bake. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to spend the next month working on Constellations, which is the other show I'm directing next season,
mm-hmm.
and trying to get my outline for part two of Astoria into a clearer shape. Because mm-hmm. what I found with this one was I had to research, and I had to distill and figure out what were the key events that I wanted to at least consider including. Mm-hmm. Because a huge piece of the decision-making process is, what am I going to leave out?
Right.
Because it's way too much.
Yeah.
And then I had to kind of create an outline that gave me some sense of what the possible scenes could be. And then I felt like I could start writing. I didn't, until I had some kind of at least track of what the evening might look like, I didn't feel like I could start writing scenes. But then once I did, I could totally, it was just like came in pretty quickly.
Did you collaborate with any other designers in advance just because of the breadth and depth of this story? I mean, you've worked with incredible designers in the theater and all over the country. So did anyone say, well, I see this, or...
No, it's funny, because I didn't want to bring people in until I had a clear sense of what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I shared the text to the design team, Tony Chizik is the set designer who's done a ton of stuff for us, including Cuckoo's Nest, and this year he did Ain't Misbehavin' and Whipping Man. So I sent them the text, and he emailed back and said he was really excited. He said, have you thought about bringing a projection designer on, you know, and doing some video stuff? And I said, I have thought very clearly that I do not want projections.
Oh.
And he was like, oh.
That's cool.
Yeah, because I'm usually, in the design process, I'm usually like, open, whatever. Mm. Bring me and let's... But it was like super clear for me that it had to be about engaging the audience's imagination. You had to really set up a game where we can say, you know what, we're on a ship, and we're on the ship.
What's cool about that is it reminds me of what you said about the young man who said, I wonder how much of this is true. Because the more, when you do projections, and especially of historic photographs, you put people's minds into someone else's mind,
mm-hmm.
the person who took the picture.
Right, right.
And instead of keeping them in their own mind, which is, golly, can make a better ship than anybody could build.
Right.
Yeah, that's so great.
Right. And that was, it was interesting at the workshop because a couple of people said, you know, we just had chairs and a couple of tables for that. They said they were so blown away by how much of it they saw.
Right.
And I thought, that, okay, so that's the goal. And one of the things I said at the design conference this last weekend, we need to have the courage to withhold as much as we can of the visual information. Don't provide the visual information for the audience. Let them provide it.
It's exciting that way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You know, like ragtime, like with our ragtime.
Right.
Yeah.
And that, to, I don't know, but that just seems to open the door for people to engage their own themselves in the story, you know? So it's so exciting. So tell me about the rest of the shows that are on the season that are
in that series.
Umbrella.
So the first one is called Hold These Truths,
mm-hmm.
and it'll be in the studio in the fall. And it is about, it's the story of Gordon Hirabayashi, who was a student at University of Washington
mm-hmm.
during when the order came out that Japanese citizens had to go to internment camps during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And he refused to go. And he refused the order. They took him to court. They eventually, he fought it all the way to the Supreme Court and lost. And he spent 18 months in federal penitentiary in Arizona. And then 40 years later, he gets a call from an attorney who was working with the Justice Department. And he was cleaning out some files, and he found this guy's file, and he said, I believe I have uncovered the fact that the military withheld evidence that would have changed your ruling, and if you are open to it, I would like to reopen your case and try it again. And he said, I've been waiting 40 years for this phone call.
Oh, it gives me the chills.
Right? And so he went back and he tried the case and he won
mm-hmm.
40 years later. And it's just, you know, it's one guy's story about, you know, his family's experience and what that was like. And, you know, and of course it has, it's not a story we tell very often here. And then we're doing Astoria, and then we're doing the Oregon Trail,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I, unlike you, I was not familiar with the computer game,
mm-hmm.
Oregon Trail.
Golly, we had lots of fun with that back in the day.
Back in the day. And when I mentioned it, I started mentioning it. It's like all of these people, you know, were like enamored of it. And the thing that's really, it's by a young woman named Becca Brunstetter. And it's about a girl, she starts about 15 years old, and she's kind of lost. And, slightly depressed, can't figure out her life. And then you track her like to about 31, 32. And she can't get her life together, but she's obsessed with the computer game, the Oregon Trail.
Mm-hmm.
And with the sense of purpose and struggle,
mm-hmm.
You know, the characters in that game are contending with. And at some point, she ends up kind of teleporting into the game, into the story of the game.
I love that.
And it's really about values. It's really about her discovering her own purpose and spine and will.
I love that. It's so interesting because it made me think of those shows that OPB has done, the reality shows where they put people into a time period and they try to hold them to the rules at that time.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
Which I really dig. It's fun. I watch those all with the girls. Because somehow, and I don't know why it is, but certain time periods seem as though their rules were much more clear than the rules we have today.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, no, you will wear your corset.
Yeah.
That's the way it is. But some women had the wherewithal to
say, not do it?
No.
Oh, wow.
And it just, I don't know, I'm fascinated by that. It sounds really interesting. Well, and I can see why she would go into that world, that world
she'd
where
be fascinated
rules are
by
clear.
That. Yeah, rules are clear. And you're, like, because she just can't figure out what her purpose is, you know? And she, you know, and she's very, you know, she's a bit like, you know, the millennials who are like sleeping at their parents, you know, in their parents' basement when they're 29, you know, and so it's hysterical. It's very, very funny. And then the last one is
you've got the musical with
Wild and Reckless,
right? Which sounds wonderful.
Which is with Blitz and Trapper.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful local band that I wasn't familiar with. I'm such an old fuddy-duddy, you know, like, so these things get introduced to me and then I get excited about them.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the thing about those guys, the music is incredible and the musicianship is incredible. But the two guys who founded the band grew up in a small town outside of Salem, rural Oregon. And there's a thread in the music thematically that is about the kids who've been lost or left behind by the boom times and by the growing urban economy. And so they had been fantasizing about maybe doing a theatrical evening. They didn't know what that meant. And so we asked if they might want to try to create a project together, and they're doing that now. They're working on it for JAW, our new play festival.
Oh, tell us the dates of that, just so people might be excited about it.
28th, 29th, 30th of July.
And then you work 2 weeks prior, and so that will be the big weekend where everyone can come, and it's so much fun. I encourage anyone who's around to go. You'll just see artists at work. It's a really beautiful open process. It's great to observe.
And it's free, and but they'll be showing, you know, what they have right now, and they're still trying to figure it out. They're trying to figure out what the narrative is. Mm-hmm. You know, Eric, the main writer, you know, his songs, a lot of them feel like short stories, but he's used to that short form. So figuring out what the long thread is,
what's the link,
and you know, is what he's trying to wrap his arms around right now. But it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Now, I understand that Astoria has musical elements.
Yeah, it does.
That's exciting.
You know, if you read the book, they talk about the fact that the voyageurs, the French-Canadian guys who paddled these canoes, that were, at the time, which was the fastest mode of transport in North America, they sang while they paddled. And you know, in the book, there are just a couple of little snippets of lyrics in French, but that didn't mean anything to me. But and I just had the instinct early on that it would be great if we heard that stuff. And so I started researching and Googling voyageur songs, you know, and there's a ton of them.
Isn't that amazing? All that literature that I did a podcast, several months ago now, with a music director who was talking about all this music in a British Museum of Music, where there's music that's thousands of years old, and there's, you know, I mean, there's this, the music of the people and of the time is so evocative.
Oh my gosh.
It's amazing.
And it's amazing, like, when I was first discovering this, I was in rehearsals for 3 Days of Rain, and Sacha Roy is from Montreal.
Oh.
And I said to him, hey, do you know any of these, like, voyageur songs? And he starts singing one.
Oh, for heaven's sake, so it's a part of their culture.
Oh, yeah.
A living part.
Yeah, and they know all the songs. And it'd be like us growing up with Yankee Doodle Dandy, you know?
Right.
And And in fact, the mascot of his high school were the Voyageurs. And I'm like,
oh my gosh, oh, yeah. Even the word is yeah. not really in our zip,
no.
guys.
And it's,
you know?
Totally in their zone.
Wow.
And the songs are great. And they sang in harmony.
Oh.
And so
past
I...
Past those time, for heaven's sake. That must have, those journeys.
Oh, sure.
Been,
oh, sure.
So
they're driving, you know, they're paddling 70, 80 miles a day on the river. And so it's, they're wonderful. The sound of them is wonderful. And Rick Lewis has done wonderful arrangements and mostly three-part harmony.
That's so great.
And then there's a couple, there's an Irish song and then there's an American drinking song. Yeah.
It's so interesting. I mean, because I'm going to do a show in the fall, well, actually Christmas time, about the Civil War. So I've been thinking about music of that time period. And I recently met up with a violinist who's also does a lot of klezmer music. And I learned the statistic that, you know, in Charleston, South Carolina, it was the largest population of Jews other than Europe in that time period.
In the Civil War?
Charleston.
Why?
I don't know. I read that and I thought, wow, that, I didn't know that. That's so interesting. The largest Jewish population. And I thought, music, just in klezmer in particular, just when we did Fiddler, this kind of started going in my brain about how music moves and who brings it and why, and the movement of European music to the North and South through immigration to the United States. And it's kind of an interesting subtextual way to get at what's going on with the people, because I'm sure the music that you're working on has, you know, a heartbeat. Just there's the lyric and then there's the music, and it probably gives you a really amazing sense of the time and the people.
Oh, well, and just, you know, just the feel of it. And there's this one section in Act Two where I've kind of threaded like six little short scenes together with this one song that they do. And I'm going to bastardize the French, but it's like, j'entends la moula, tiki-tiki-taka, j'entends la moula, taka, j'entends la moula, tiki-tiki-taka. You know, and it's just like, the sound of it is so, so delicious.
Yeah, and there's a interesting, the difficulty of their work kind of countered by the lightness of a song like that.
Oh, and
it's
they're
really
all, and they're
neat.
Always
keep their head in a place of I'm doing this.
And they're all the songs are about a girl left behind. Oh. You know, they're always all about you know, a girl.
And that's true.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really great fun.
Oh, thank you so much for talking to me about this.
Absolutely,
it's really exciting stuff.
It's fun.
Yeah, I hope
really
everybody
fun.
Comes and watches the process of the plays that are being written, plus come see the season at Portland Center Stage, and you can go to the website at www.pcs.org and read your heart out. You can come to JAW, you can come just hang out in the building and put on your computer and enjoy the beauty of the Armory. There's all sorts of things to do here. Thanks again, Chris.
Absolutely.